Chapter 117. Tyrant Soester, which, as he has acquired this infamous celebrity, you will no doubt wish to have engraved for the purpose of presenting a copy with every copy of your next number. I enclose it. Picture which cannot be reproduced. The under beetle has consented to write his life, but it is to be strictly anonymous. The accompanying likeness is of course from the life, and complete in every respect. Even if I had been totally ignorant of the man's real character, and it had been placed before me without remark, I should have shuddered involuntarily. There is an intense malignity of expression in the features, and a baleful ferocity of purpose in the ruffian's eye, which apples and sickens. His whole air is rampant with cruelty, nor is the stomach less characteristic of his demoniac propensities. Apostrophe, Monday. The great day has at length arrived. I have neither eyes, nor ears, nor pens, nor ink, nor paper, for anything but the wonderful proceedings that have astounded my senses. Let me collect my energies and proceed to the account. Section A, Zoology and Botany. Front Parlor, Black Boy and Stomachache. President Sir William Joltard. Vice Presidents Mr. Mudlibrins and Mr. Drawley. Mr. 10. 10. Misty communicated some remarks on the disappearance of dancing bears from the streets of London, with observations on the exhibition of monkeys as connected with barrel organs. The writer had observed, with feelings of the utmost pain and regret, that some years ago a sudden and unaccountable change in the public taste took place with reference to itinerant bears, who, being discountenanced by the populace, gradually fell off one by one from the streets of the metropolis, until not one remained to create a taste for natural history in the breasts of the poor and uninstructed. One bear, indeed, a brown and ragged animal, had lingered about the haunts of his former triumphs, with a worn and dejected visage and feeble limbs, and had essayed to wield his quarter-staff for the amusement of the multitude. But hunger, and another want of any due recompense for his abilities, had at length driven him from the field, and it was only too probable that he had fallen a sacrifice to the rising taste for grease. He regretted to add that a similar, and no less lamentable, change had taken place with reference to monkeys. These delightful animals had formerly been almost as plentiful as the organs on the tops, of which they were accustomed to sit. The proportion in the year 1829, it appeared by the parliamentary return, being as one monkey to three organs. Owing, however, to an altered taste in musical instruments, and the substitution, in a great measure, of narrow boxes of music for organs, which left the monkeys nothing to sit upon, this source of public amusement was wholly dried up. Considering it a matter of the deepest importance, in connection with national education, that the people should not lose such opportunities of making themselves acquainted with the manners and customs of two most interesting species of animals, the author submitted that some measures should be immediately taken for the restoration of these pleasing and truly intellectual amusements. The president inquired by what means the honorable member proposed to attain this most desirable end. The author submitted that it could be most fully and satisfactorily accomplished if Her Majesty's government would cause to be brought over to England, and maintained at the public expense, and for the public amusement, such a number of bears as would enable every quarter of the town to be visited, say at least by three bears a week. No difficulty whatever need be experienced in providing a fitting place for the reception of these animals, as a commodious bear garden could be erected in the immediate neighborhood of both houses of Parliament, obviously the most proper and eligible spot for such an establishment. Professor Mull doubted very much whether any correct ideas of natural history were propagated by the means to which the honorable member had so ably adverted. On the contrary, he believed that they had been the means of diffusing very incorrect and imperfect notions on the subject. He spoke from personal observation and personal experience, when he said that many children of great abilities had been induced to believe, from what they had observed in the streets, at and before the period to which the honorable gentleman had referred, that all monkeys were born in red coats and spangles, and that their hats and feathers also came by nature. He wished to know distinctly whether the honorable gentleman attributed the want of encouragement the bears had met with to the decline of public taste in that respect, or to a want of ability on the part of the bears themselves. Mr. Ten. Ten. Misty replied that he could not bring himself to believe, but that there must be a great deal of floating talent among the bears and monkeys generally, which, in the absence of any proper encouragement, was dispersed in other directions. Professor Pumpkinskull wished to take that opportunity of calling the attention of the section to a most important and serious point. The author of the treatise just read had alluded to the prevalent taste for bear's grease as a means of promoting the growth of hair, which undoubtedly was diffused to a very great, and, as it appeared to him, very alarming extent. No gentleman attending that section could fail to be aware of the fact that the youth of the present age evinced, by their behavior in the streets, and at all places of public resort, a considerable lack of that gallantry and gentlemanly feeling which, in more ignorant times, had been thought becoming. He wished to know whether it were possible that a constant outward application of bear's grease by the young gentlemen about town had imperceptibly infused into those unhappy persons something of the nature and quality of the bear. He shuddered as he threw out the remark, but if this theory, on inquiry, should prove to be well-founded, it would at once explain a great deal of unpleasant eccentricity of behavior, which, without some such discovery, was wholly unaccountable. The president highly complimented the learned gentleman on his most valuable suggestion, which produced the greatest effect upon the assembly, and remarked that only a week previous he had seen some young gentlemen at a theater eyeing a box of ladies with a fierce intensity, which nothing but the influence of some brutish appetite could possibly explain. It was dreadful to reflect that our youth were so rapidly verging into a generation of bears. After a scene of scientific enthusiasm, it was resolved that this important question should be immediately submitted to the consideration of the council. The president wished to know whether any gentleman could inform the section what had become of the dancing dogs. A member replied, after some hesitation, that on the day after three glee singers had been committed to prison as criminals by a late most zealous police magistrate of the metropolis, the dogs had abandoned their professional duties and dispersed themselves in different quarters of the town to gain a livelihood by less dangerous means. He was given to understand that since that period they had supported themselves by lying in wait for and robbing blind men's poodles. Mr. Flummery exhibited a twig, claiming to be a veritable branch of that noble tree known to naturalists as the Shakespeare, which has taken root in every land and climate, and gathered under the shade of its broad green boughs the great family of mankind. The learned gentleman remarked that the twig had been undoubtedly called by other names in its time, but that it had been pointed out to him by an old lady in Warwickshire, where the great tree had grown, as a shoot of the genuine Shakespeare, by which name he begged to introduce it to his countrymen. The president wished to know what botanical definition the honorable gentleman could afford of the curiosity. Mr. Flummery expressed his opinion that it was a decided plant. Section B, display of models and mechanical science. Large room, bootjack and countenance. President, Mr. Mallet. Vice President, Messrs. Lever and Screw. Mr. Crinkles exhibited a most beautiful and delicate machine, of little larger size than an ordinary snuff box, manufactured entirely by himself, and composed exclusively of steel, by the aid of which more pockets could be picked in 1 hour than by the present slow and tedious process in 4 and 20. The inventor remarked that it had been put into active operation in Fleet Street, the Strand, and other thoroughfares, and had never been once known to fail. After some slight delay, occasioned by the various members of the section buttoning their pockets, the president narrowly inspected the invention, and declared that he had never seen a machine of more beautiful or exquisite construction. Would the inventor be good enough to inform the section whether he had taken any, and what means for bringing it into general operation? Mr. Crinkle stated that, after encountering some preliminary difficulties, he had succeeded in putting himself in communication with Mr. Fogelhunter and other gentlemen connected with the swell mob, who had awarded the invention the very highest and most unqualified approbation. He regretted to say, however, that these distinguished practitioners, in common with a gentleman of the name of Gimlet-eyed Tommy, and other members of a secondary grade of the profession whom he was understood to represent, entertained an insuperable objection to its being brought into general use, on the ground that it would have the inevitable effect of almost entirely superseding manual labor, and throwing a great number of highly deserving persons out of employment. The president hoped that no such fanciful objections would be allowed to stand in the way of such a great public improvement. Mr. Crinkles hoped so too, but he feared that, if the gentlemen of the swell mob persevered in their objection, nothing could be done. Professor Grime suggested that surely, in that case, Her Majesty's government might be prevailed upon to take it up. Mr. Crinkle said that if the objection were found to be insuperable, he should apply to Parliament, which he thought could not fail to recognize the utility of the invention. The president observed that, up to this time, Parliament had certainly got on very well without it. But, as they did their business on a very large scale, he had no doubt they would gladly adopt the improvement. His only fear was that the machine might be worn out by constant working. Mr. Copernicus called the attention of the section to a proposition of great magnitude and interest, illustrated by a vast number of models, and stated with much clearness and perspicuity in a treatise entitled Practical Suggestions on the Necessity of Providing Some Harmless and Wholesome Relaxation for the Young Noblemen of England. His proposition was that a space of ground of not less than 10 miles in length and 4 in breadth should be purchased by a new company, to be incorporated by Act of Parliament, and enclosed by a brick wall of not less than 12 feet in height. He proposed that it should be laid out with highway roads, turnpikes, bridges, miniature villages, and every object that could conduce to the comfort and glory of foreign hand clubs, so that they might be fairly presumed to require no drive beyond it. This delightful retreat would be fitted up with most commodious and extensive stables, for the convenience of such of the nobility and gentry as had a taste for ostlering, and with houses of entertainment furnished in the most expensive and handsome style. It would be further provided with whole streets of door knockers and bell handles of extra size, so constructed that they could be easily wrenched off at night and regularly screwed on again by attendants provided for the purpose every day. There would also be gas lamps of real glass, which could be broken at a comparatively small expense per dozen, and a broad and handsome foot pavement for gentlemen to drive their cabriolets upon when they were humorously disposed, for the full enjoyment of which feet live pedestrians would be procured from the workhouse at a very small charge per head. The place being enclosed and carefully screened from the intrusion of the public, there would be no objection to gentlemen laying aside any article of their costume that was considered to interfere with a pleasant frolic, or, indeed, to their walking about without any costume at all, if they liked that better. In short, every facility of enjoyment would be afforded that the most gentlemanly person could possibly desire. But as even these advantages would be incomplete, unless there were some means provided of enabling the nobility and gentry to display their prowess when they sallied forth after dinner, and as some inconvenience might be experienced in the event of their being reduced to the necessity of pummeling each other, the inventor had turned his attention to the construction of an entirely new police force, composed exclusively of automaton figures, which, with the assistance of the ingenious Signor Gagliardi, of Windmill Street, and the Haymarket, he had succeeded in making with such nicety, that a policeman, cab driver, or old woman, made upon the principle of the models exhibited, would walk about until knocked down like any real man. Nay, more, if set upon and beaten by six or eight noblemen or gentlemen, after it was down, the figure would utter divers groans, mingled with entreaties for mercy, thus rendering the illusion complete, and the enjoyment perfect. But the invention did not stop even here, for station houses would be built, containing good beds for noblemen and gentlemen during the night, and in the morning they would repair to a commodious police office, where a pantomimic investigation would take place before the automaton magistrates, quite equal to life, who would find them in so many counters, with which they would be previously provided for the purpose. This office would be furnished with an inclined plane, for the convenience of any nobleman or gentleman who might wish to bring in his horse as a witness, and the prisoners would be at perfect liberty, as they were now, to interrupt the complainants as much as they pleased, and to make any remarks that they thought proper. The charge for these amusements would amount to very little more than they already cost, and the inventor submitted that the public would be much benefited and comforted by the proposed arrangement. Professor Nogo wished to be informed what amount of automaton police force it was proposed to raise in the first instance. Mr. Copernicus replied that it was proposed to begin with 7 divisions of police of a score each, lettered from A to G inclusive. It was proposed that not more than half this number should be placed on active duty, and that the remainder should be kept on shelves in the police office ready to be called out at a moment's notice. The president, awarding the utmost merit to the ingenious gentleman who had originated the idea, doubted whether the automaton police would quite answer the purpose. He feared that noblemen and gentlemen would perhaps require the excitement of thrashing living subjects. Mr. Copernicus submitted that as the usual odds in such cases were 10 noblemen or gentlemen to 1 policeman or cab driver, it could make very little difference in point of excitement whether the policeman or cab driver were a man or a block. The great advantage would be that a policeman's limbs might be all knocked off, and yet he would be in a condition to do duty next day. He. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.